Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is military life like for 21st century women, and what drives them to serve in an environment that was designed to meet the needs of male soldiers and commanders? As my guest today will tell us, women enlist in the armed services for some of the same reasons as men: love of country, career advancement, money for school, hope of a good post-military job. And they faced some of the same risks even before the official declaration to allow women in combat. Journalist Helen Thorpe joins us to talk about the special challenges of female soldiers and how they learn to cope with them. Her new book is called Soldier Girls: The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War. Helen, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So you can't possibly take three subjects and make them archetypes of every woman in the military, and wisely you did not try. But talk about how you found your subjects and what made you decide that they were a good place to begin telling this story of women in the military.
Sure. The first of the three women that I met was actually the youngest of them all, and her name in the book is Michelle Fisher, which is actually a pseudonym. She was 18 years old when she enlisted in the National Guard, and she was a really unlikely candidate in the sense that she had just voted for Ralph Nader in the preceding presidential election, and she thought of herself as like a left-leaning hippie, and she felt at odds with her colleagues in the Guard. But she really was desperate to figure out a way to pay for college and a way out of the circumstances she found herself in. Her mom was on and off welfare. Her dad was in and out of prison. She had siblings drinking too much or doing meth. And she really wanted to understand how you got a job that wasn't a factory job. And so she walked into a recruiting office in March 2001 and enlisted in the Guard, completely not foreseeing that anything like 9/11 would ever happen. And then after I met Michelle, she introduced me to her two closest friends from her unit in the National Guard. And their names are Desma Brooks and Debbie Helton. So Desma was a single mother with three children. She herself had grown up partly in the foster care system. She had a very rough life. She took one look at Michelle Fisher and thought, well, Michelle really had it easy because she was figuring out how to go to college. And Desma herself had dropped out of high school and had never figured out how to get into college in the first place. The reader, I guess, wonders at a certain point in the book if Michelle's going to get in more trouble being friends with Desma or getting deployed to a war zone, because Desma has these like dysfunctional coping mechanisms, like prescription pills and having affairs with people, and you're wondering if she's going to get Michelle in trouble all the time. But actually, she kind of is taking care of Michelle at the same time. Debbie is 30 years older than Michelle, so when 9/11 happened, Michelle was 18 and Debbie was 49. By the time they deploy, you know, Michelle's 21 and Debbie's 52. So she's in her early 50s, Debbie, by the time the deployments are happening. She's one of the longest serving women in their National Guard unit, and she had kind of helped integrate the unit when women were first allowed to join that part of the military.
And Debbie initially didn't look like she would deploy overseas, and she was really upset about this.
Yeah. So Debbie kind of represents the good soldier, or the person who fits very comfortably in the military. She views the chance to serve her country, the chance to go overseas to a war zone, as potentially the highlight of her life. She really, really, really wants to go with her unit. But she's been told she will stay back because she's possibly because she thinks maybe because she's older and she's female. She's furious when she learns this young woman, Michelle Fisher, is going to take a spot on the armament team that she thought might be her spot. They actually end up deploying together. Debbie lobbies to go, and when another member of the team gets sick, they do call her up and ask her to serve after all. And she writes in her diary that she shared with me, "Nobody will understand, but I'm a happy camper," when she gets the deployment news. Hmm. So they do have really different responses to the deployment and the idea of the wars in general.
And they came into this with different politics. To what extent did it matter to their relationships, how they felt about the war and about America's role in the conflicts overseas?
Yes, they did have different politics. So Michelle, as I mentioned, had voted for Ralph Nader in the 2000 presidential election. Her very good friend, Desma Brooks, the single mom with three kids that she winds up sharing a tent with during their first deployment to Afghanistan, Desma had voted for George W. Bush in that same election. And Desma wholeheartedly supported the war in Afghanistan as an appropriate response to 9/11, whereas Michelle was against the war. Debbie, interestingly, dislikes politics so much that she has never voted in an election. She's not even registered to vote. She just thinks politicians are not good people. And she only trusts military figures. So the only person in the federal government that Debbie really puts faith in is Colin Powell. So they have these very, very different views. And yet when they arrive in Afghanistan together, those positions that would divide them when they're at home don't matter as much. What matters more is the fact that they're all really funny. They're really, really smart. They love spending time together. They make each other laugh. They make the deployments easier for each other. And partly that's by rebelling against the authority figures on the post and doing things they're not meant to be doing, and then entertaining each other with stories and about their own misbehavior and things like this. They're very colorful characters.
It's a tiny, funny story, but I think it's when Desma realizes that she's going to like Michelle after all, is that every day Michelle gets in trouble for wearing this like rainbow-colored ankle bracelet.
Yeah.
And can you tell that story?
Yes. So Michelle Fisher, you know, has learned that she has to go to Afghanistan after all. She's 21. She's just fallen in love. She's heartbroken at being separated from this young man that she's just moved in with. And she's also furious at being sent to a war that she personally opposes. And she packs with her, with all her military gear and clothing, rainbow-colored hemp. And her company commander spots this rainbow-colored hemp ankle bracelet that she's made for herself and tells her she must take it off. And she stubbornly braids herself a new rainbow hemp anklet every day. And every day he's telling her to take it off, and every day she's making herself a new one. Around that same time, Desma Brooks has been ordered to work in supply. And she's been trained to be a automated logistics specialist. So her training is to work on computer software, ordering the parts they need for trucks or weapons, and keeping track of the maintenance of the trucks and the weapons that's being done by their unit. But now she's in supply where she's like filling out forms to order food and other things that their unit needs. And she starts acting out. So at one point, she decides that she wants to order frozen hamburger meat and hot dogs and hot dog buns and kegs. And then she decides to make this. She's decided to throw an impromptu party with nobody's authorization. And then she decides she'd really like to have a horse at the party. So she orders a Clydesdale horse, because she's basically discovered you can order almost anything if you're working in supply. And that she thinks it's really funny that the federal government has a serial number for everything, including like a Clydesdale horse as opposed to some other breed of horse. So she's getting in trouble that way. And Michelle and Desma bond during this time as they're watching each other sort of do these rebellious things, acting out because they've been ordered to deploy.
Talk about what it's like for women who are deployed as compared with their male colleagues. How do they bond with the other women as compared with the way that they bond with their male coworkers?
So one of the things that really struck me that I'd never thought about or imagined was when they found themselves in Afghanistan wearing a uniform, they felt very unfeminine. And Michelle, for example, found this really troubling. She didn't feel like herself, because every day she put on this uniform that she viewed as like a male uniform. And, you know, being soldiers in the National Guard, they had never thought they would be wearing the uniform full time. Mm-hmm. In the National Guard, they had expected to go to drill 1 weekend a month and then 2 weeks in the summer, very part time a version of being a soldier.
And excuse me for interrupting. They thought if they got called up, they would have to like help in a flood somewhere in the state of Indiana.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's what they had anticipated when they signed up. And then, of course, we had this unforeseeable decade with two wars, and none of them had really foreseen what might happen. But they were put on active duty and at that point had to go on year-long deployments. So they went first to Afghanistan, came back, and then later two of the women went to Iraq. So here's Michelle. She had never foreseen becoming a full-time soldier. She's wearing the uniform every day, and she just doesn't feel like a woman. And so she goes online and starts ordering Victoria's Secret underwear in gold panties, matching panty and under bra sets, and green and black. And then she's putting those on under her uniform. And then the other women in her tent see what she's doing, and then they all start ordering those things. And I think it was really almost as much for each other as it was for any of the men they might be interested in at that moment in time. And, you know, they lived 10 people in a tent, and they lived in very, very, very close quarters. And I think there was friction as a result of being kind of crammed in together. But over time, I think Michelle would say that she bonded with every single person in that tent, including the people she didn't get along with, just because you become a family mm-hmm. over time. So the ways in which that might be the same or different than their male counterparts, I know that one thing each of the women described was this intense male attention they got while they were there on post. They found themselves in an environment where the gender ratio was really skewed. So they were in a mixed gender battalion where the ratio might be 2-1. Two men for every one woman. But their battalion was deployed on a post alongside of all male units. And so when they found themselves there, they were even more scarce. Women were even more scarce than what they'd been used to. And Michelle, being just 21 at that point in time and very attractive and long blonde curly hair, whenever she walked around the military post, guys she didn't even know would read her name tag on her uniform and say her last name out loud and call out to her. So she was just constantly, every day, anytime she was outside of the tent, getting all this attention. And I think the women bonded with each other almost to seek relief from that environment. And their female friendships became hugely important.
And was there a sense that they were vulnerable? Do they recognize going in that they would be vulnerable because of that attention?
I think that as they were entering the military, each of them had experiences that would hint at what that environment might be like in a war zone. So, for example, Desma says that she was assaulted by the military recruiter who recruited her to join the military after she had signed the documents saying she would commit to doing military service. Michelle, when she was in training, she had finished basic training and she was doing weapons training to become a small weapons mechanic. And a drill sergeant who was 36 and she was 18 at the time, you know, flirted with her and gave her photographs of himself and seduced her in this way. And she had a brief affair with him. It was in a relationship that the military clearly would ban and prohibit. It's illegal. It shouldn't have happened. And, understood that it was a real problem that he had paid her this sort of attention, and she understood she needed to look out for men like that in the military. So I think they had an inkling.
My guest is journalist Helen Thorpe. Her new book is called Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Helen Thorpe about her new book, Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Helen, they all left behind lives and people that they cared about. It does seem like Desma left behind the most complicated situation. Can you tell us a little bit about the story with her three children and how they were taken care of while she was abroad?
Yeah. So the three women that I'm writing about, they become incredibly close friends, but they represent very different life stages. So you had Michelle, a young college student with no children, Desma, a single mom with three kids, and Debbie, who became a grandmother while they were in Afghanistan. And for sure, Desma, I think, had maybe the greatest commitments at home that she was struggling to balance as a mother with young children. Her two daughters were in kindergarten and first grade. You know, her son was in elementary school during the first deployment. And leaving children so young as a single parent, it was a huge juggling act for her. And as a civilian myself and a mother, I remember asking Desma, well, why did you go? I mean, why wouldn't you find a way to stay at home with your kids? And she looked at me like, what, are you crazy? You know, when I asked her that question, and her response was, everybody was leaving kids. Okay, she was a single mom, but there were other single moms in the military, and there were men who were single parents, or there were people who were married and had children, but everybody in her unit was leaving their kids. And she said, I would be a dirtbag if I weaseled out of a deployment. You know, everybody in my unit was going. You all get deployed, you all go. And she had this huge sense of obligation that to her fellow soldiers, you know, if they were going, she needed to go. But she also really understood in a visceral way what it meant to leave her children from her kids' point of view. So she always felt guilty about doing that. She had left her son, her oldest child, once before when she had gone to basic training. And when she came back from basic training, you know, 6 months later, he had developed a stutter during her absence. And she knew that was because he found this long separation from her so hard to bear. So she understood it was going to hurt her children for her to leave. She struggled as a mother. You know, she would try to find quiet corners on the military post where she could call her kids. She tried to make sure not to call them at the same time every week so that if she missed a phone call, they wouldn't start to worry. She was trying to figure out, you know, how to buy them Christmas gifts online and have the gifts arrive at the right time and all those things. She was trying to mother long distance for the whole year that she was gone.
Anyone who's taken a business trip as a parent knows that that's hard, even under the best of circumstances.
Right. And those trips are so short by comparison. The lengths of these deployments were just brutal.
So what kind of contact was it? I mean, was it emotionally satisfying contact when they would call home, when they would email, when they would just be back in touch with the people they left behind?
What Desma describes with her children is she would say the same thing every phone call. I'll be home before you know it. And it got to where she would say, when will I be home? And her daughters would say, before we know it. So she was trying to reassure them, and maybe she was also trying to reassure herself at the same time that this is going to end soon. But I don't think, you know, that stealing a phone call every now and then or sending emails that are just a few lines long or whatever you have time to write, it's obviously not the same thing as being in your children's lives full time. And she knew that she was missing out tremendously, and she knew that they were battling feelings of abandonment. So I don't think their interactions were what she would call emotionally satisfying, but she was just doing the best she could.
And there are a number of romantic encounters. There are relationships. There are sexual encounters. You know, these women, life goes on, and in a lot of ways that maybe they couldn't have imagined had they been outside military service.
Yeah. It was extraordinary to me to get to know these three women, and I'm kind of in awe of them because they seem so incredibly capable to me, and they did their jobs so well. They also, you know, at times did not behave as a model soldier necessarily in the following ways. You know, Desma and Michelle, maybe even more than Debbie, had these coping mechanisms that in their cases involved prescription pills, affairs with men they technically should not have been sleeping with, smoking pot. And, you know, they were trying to get through a lengthy deployment that they didn't necessarily want to be on, although they wanted to do a good job with a commitment they'd been asked to honor. So they did a terrific job at work, but then they also just tried to get by and make the time easier for themselves in these ways. And I think, you know, what emerges, they shared letters and diaries and emails about all of this. And I think what emerges from is this really intimate portrait of their lives where you see them acting in ways that, you know, maybe a military recruiter wouldn't hand out this book saying this is the military that they want to describe in their recruiting brochures. But I think it's a reality that men and women who've served their country would recognize as real and authentic and very honest.
I was surprised at the easy access that they seem to have had to intoxicating substances while deployed.
Well, they weren't supposed to have had access to anything like that.
Right.
But so on the military post, not only were illegal drugs like marijuana or hash banned, but alcohol was also banned. So they weren't meant to be intoxicated in any way, shape, or form at any point in time. But Debbie, who's the oldest of the three women and the one who became a grandmother while overseas, she likes to have a cocktail or two in the evening. And that's her lifelong habit. She's dependent on that. She understands herself to need alcohol in order to relax in the evening and let go of a stressful day. So she figured out how to buy alcohol at a grocery and liquor store called Supreme Foods. So Supreme Foods is a chain that has sprung up throughout the war zones in Afghanistan and Iraq, that's run by a former member of the U.S. military, if I'm remembering correctly. And it caters specifically to U.S. military overseas who are not supposed to be drinking, for the most part. So it's actually readily available. So technically, she wasn't supposed to be having a cocktail, but she wasn't the only one doing it. Michelle and Desma went a little bit further, and they did buy hash at one point. More often, they were getting the medics on the post to write them prescriptions for things like Vicodin, which they took to calm down in the evening if there was a rocket launch attack or something like RPGs were coming and they were wound up and they needed to sleep. Michelle became reliant on taking prescription pills in order to be able to sleep at night.
Can you tell us about Akbar Khan?
So he is this incredibly interesting young man that Michelle and Debbie begin to work with in the fall of 2004, as they're in Afghanistan. Their job is to fix broken AK-47s. So these weapons have been collected from the militias throughout Afghanistan through a United Nations program to bring in weaponry, and they're being refurbished and then handed out to the Afghan National Army. So they're fixing broken weapons left over from decades of conflict in Afghanistan and trying to arm the Afghan National Army, which is supposed to then defend the democracy that's being built in Afghanistan. And Akbar Khan is their translator. So they've had various translators in the early weeks, but they come across him one day, and right away he strikes every member of the armament team as incredibly intelligent and charismatic. The armament team to work on the AK-47s, they're actually leaving the safety of their military post in Kabul. The post is called Camp Phoenix, and they're traveling to other locations where these broken AK-47s are being kept. And sometimes they're working with the Afghan National Army, teaching them how to clean the weapons or use the weapons. And he's translating for them continuously from the moment they leave the post till they come back. So along the way, not only does he help them do their work, but he starts to basically convey to them, you know, the magic of this foreign country they find themselves in. And they kind of fall in love with him and Afghanistan and this foreign culture they're getting to understand slowly over time. Much to their surprise, toward the end of their deployment, Akbar Khan has gotten kind of close to Michelle Fisher, and his mother swoops in and decides, oops, he's getting a little too cozy with this female soldier from America. She better marry him off. So she creates an arranged marriage. And for Michelle and Debbie and the other members of the armament team, watching this young person they love suddenly find himself in an arranged marriage to a first cousin he's never met. He doesn't want to marry this young woman that he's never met. He'd much rather, you know, marry Michelle. It becomes a very dramatic moment where they really understand, maybe on a deeper level, the differences between Afghan and American societies.
It's, and I don't want to carry the joke too far here, but there's a point at which I think it's Debbie who says to him, you can't marry your first cousin. You know, your kids will be idiots. And he says, actually, my parents are first cousins.
Exactly.
It's like something that the Americans can't understand. And then he can't understand, I suppose, how this is so very foreign to them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Talk about the moments when they would come home between deployments. I mean, that whole process of trying to shake off what you've been through, in some cases very traumatic experiences, and pick up in a society where a lot of people don't even really get what you've been up to.
Yeah. So there's the book follows these three women over a 12-year period of time, and there are two different deployments that the reader watches take place, and then two different homecomings. And all three women went to Afghanistan in the first deployment, and all three struggled coming home. In many ways, the second deployment was even harder, and the struggles were even greater the second time. Right after the first deployment, coming back after they were in Afghanistan, Michelle Fisher is trying to figure out now how to re-enter the world of college, but she is suddenly a few years older than her peers. And even though she thinks of herself as still left-leaning, and again, she's voted for Ralph Nader a second time at this point, all the people that she would normally gravitate toward at college, the other left-leaning young people, they find her incomprehensible because she's been to war, and they think of her as like, I don't know if they think of her as like a baby killer or something. You know, they have these very negative stereotypes of what it means to be a soldier.
Right.
And they're viewing her with like horror or repulsion. And she's thinking, well, yeah, I used to identify with you, but now you've got these silly stereotypes about soldiers in your mind, and you won't even listen to me. You won't even ask me what my life was like, you know. So she's finding herself in encounters that make her angry with her fellow students. And it's deeply ironic because she signed up for the military in the first place to get the experience of going to college. And, you know, she has wanted to be on this campus for years, and she finally gets there. And then she's having these strange encounters with fellow students. But she does have moments where people, civilians, will show her they really do care about what her life was like. And one professor, for example, it's a psychology class, so there's no reason for him to put this question on an exam, but he puts an extra credit question on an exam saying, who created this weapon? And then there's a picture of an AK-47. And she knows the answer right away, that Kalashnikov, but the other kids on campus might not know that. And she knows he put that question there for her to say, your military experience matters to me, and I know that you got an education of a different kind while you were overseas, and it's worth something here. Each of them has panic attacks when they come back. Michelle has one in Target. Desma has one in a grocery store. You know, they're surrounded in those moments by all these material goods that they haven't seen in a long time. They're essentially in like an overstimulating environment. They're being asked to make choices. There's like, you know, it seems like 24 brands of cereal or 24 brands of toilet paper in front of them. And they're just overwhelmed in those moments by this experience. You know, they've been living on a military post where other people would cook their meals and do their laundry. Their lives were very regimented. They didn't have to make a lot of choices. So just coming home, just getting used to civilian life again is very bumpy. But they have each other and they rely on each other. They're calling and texting each other constantly.
Jumping into that and also suddenly being mom again has to be incredibly
right.
difficult.
For Desma, coming back, she describes walking into the house and realizing she has to cook dinner for her children, but she hasn't cooked dinner for anybody for a year, and she sort of can't remember what was it that they liked. And she opens up the fridge and looks inside, and there isn't anything there. So that's when she realizes she has to go to the grocery store. And then, you know, as the days go by and the weeks go by, you know, the laundry is mounding up, and she's realizing she has to get in the habit of doing laundry again, but she's been out of that habit for a while now. Just the basic tasks of daily life overwhelm her at first. And she also struggles with a feeling of being very insignificant, which she describes very, very eloquently. She says that she just has this feeling that other people look at her and their eyes kind of pass over her and she doesn't register as significant. She's battling that feeling of insignificance as she's coming back from that deployment.
We're speaking with journalist Helen Thorpe about her new book, Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Helen Thorpe, author of Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 by sending me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think or by sending email to think@kera.org. We hear now via email from Pam, who says, thanks for this show. I'm a female veteran and I felt everything these women felt. I was one of 23 women in a camp of 500 guys. We had to learn to watch our backs, but I've had more trouble dealing with civilians than military. Anything you want to add to that or comment on, Helen?
She would love these three women and they would love her. I mean, what she's saying right there very succinctly just is exactly the essence of the experience these three women had, I think, right there in a nutshell. The guys seemed difficult when they were on the post at times, but then when they got home, it was much harder fitting in at home in many ways. Yeah.
You alluded to this earlier, but the tour of duty in Iraq was really hard, particularly for Desma.
So, yeah, I'm glad you're asking about that because it feels to me as though Desma kind of steals the show a little bit towards the end of the book because her second deployment is so much more challenging. So their unit deployed to Iraq in 2008, which was a very intense time in the sense that both wars were starting to take a darker, more violent turn. And especially in Iraq, things had really gotten incredibly violent and difficult. Michelle actually did not go on the second deployment because her commitment to the military had ended 2 weeks before they got their orders. Debbie and Desma did go. Debbie found herself working in headquarters, almost in a secretarial role, in a relatively safe environment. But Desma was actually deployed initially with a previously all-male infantry unit, where in a company of 100 individuals, she was one of only two or three women. That environment was really uncomfortable. The guys didn't want to speak to her. They wouldn't sit with her at lunch. She was shunned. She just found it hostile, and she requested a transfer, which did come through right before she landed in Iraq. It actually happened while they were in Kuwait. So then she transferred into, again, a formerly all-male unit. This one was a field artillery regiment. It had always been male until this moment when it was being deployed to Iraq, not in a traditional field artillery capacity, but in a support capacity. So typically, women wouldn't be allowed to serve in this unit because they would be doing combat. But when they were in Iraq, they were doing convoy security, and women were allowed to do that work. So a few women were transferred into the unit to fill empty slots, and Desma was one of those women.
This is incredibly dangerous work that she's doing.
Exactly. So for a full year, she's in a company of, say the ratio is something like 100 guys to 2 to 3 women. And her job is to drive a gun truck at the front of a supply convoy where the military is providing security to trucks that might be bringing milk or chips or food or water or fuel or Hellfire missiles. Who knows what's in those trucks? It changes all the time. But these goods are being shipped onto the military posts that the U.S. has established around Iraq. So she is in one of the first three trucks at the front of the supply convoy, and usually her job is navigation, helping them stay on course, but sometimes she's running assistant scout, and then the job of her truck is to help look for roadside bombs. So the first two trucks are scanning the highway for bombs, and if anybody in the convoy is going to get hit, it's usually going to be one of those first two trucks. So it's a very, very, very dangerous job that she's finding herself doing.
And what happened?
She survived most of the year in Iraq unscathed, although you see bombs go off around her and affect other individuals in her unit. But then it's October 19th in 2008, and her truck, they're in a convoy. It's driving around Baiji, and they see a silver box, a box with silver tape on it beside the road. And the lead scout is saying, I want to check out that box. And he tries to look down into the box. It's standing open, and he wants to see if there's anything inside it. And he says, I can't see inside. You guys take a look. So he drives forward, and Desma drives her truck as close as she can get to the box without hitting it. And suddenly, she's hearing a high-pitched squealing noise. She can't see. Everything's black. You know, her truck has been thrown up in the air. Her radio has disconnected from the impact of a bomb that's just gone off, and the squealing noise she's hearing is the sound of the disconnected radio. Her helmet has actually slipped down over her eyes, which is why she doesn't realize that at first, but that's why she can't see anything. So their truck has been, it was almost on top of the bomb. She actually ran over a tripwire, so she didn't hit the box, but she triggered a bomb that was inside that box. She and everybody in the truck have major concussions. Ultimately, she will, several months later, be diagnosed with mild traumatic brain injury. And she does come home with a really significant case of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Meanwhile, her children had been struggling. I was really moved to read that when she was on a mission, she couldn't bear to have pictures of her kids with her.
She found that she needed to keep photographs of her children in a wall locker in her. So they lived in what she would call a CHU, but I know that doesn't mean anything to a civilian. And so I remember the conversation with her was, I said, what's a CHU? And she said, oh, it's a containerized housing unit. I'm like, okay, what's a containerized housing unit? And she's like, oh, it's a CONEX. And I'm like, what's a Connex? And she says, it's a shipping container, you know, those big, long rectangular boxes. I'm like, oh, okay. So that's what they were living in, were shipping containers that had been put out there in the desert on this military post called Q West, where she was living. I mean, they had windows in them, but they were essentially these long rectangular boxes. And inside they had twin beds and little nightstands and wall lockers. That was all the furniture they had. If they wanted to use a bathroom or even brush their teeth, they would walk to this communal bathroom a little ways away. But she kept the pictures of her children locked up in her wall locker so she wouldn't come across them accidentally. She would always know if she was about to see them because it was so upsetting for her to look at their faces while she was over there.
And why was it so upsetting for her?
Oh, I think she just wanted to be with them right away, and she couldn't bear the idea. I think she wanted to protect their childhood and their vulnerabilities, and here she was in this very, very dangerous situation where her life was at risk, and I think she found it intolerable, the idea that, you know, if she was out on a mission, she really didn't want to see their photographs because it would make her realize the risk she was taking, that she might not get to return to them and what that would mean for them, I think.
How did they all deal with the lack of privacy during deployments?
They were very uncomfortable with that initially. I mean, Debbie writes this almost comical thing in her diary that she shared with me during the first deployment in Afghanistan, where she wrote, "I've got gas galore, these poor souls," meaning, you know, she's farting up a storm in her tent and nine other women that are sharing the tent with her can't but smell, you know, and it's the kind of thing you might subject a partner to in an intimate relationship in the middle of the night, but you're not thinking that your colleagues are going to have to go through it with you. They got used to it over time. And then I think when they were returning to civilian life, I don't know that they missed living in a tent exactly, but they were really used to going through everything with their colleagues in this very close way. And it was really strange for them to find themselves back in Indiana living several hours away from these other soldiers they knew so well. And they missed each other terribly when they got home.
When they look back on this period in their lives right now, I mean, they have different responses in terms of how they feel about it. But Michelle feels like it was a mistake, like she shouldn't have joined in the first place.
I think Michelle would say that she still feels the wars were a mistake, but that she wouldn't trade the year she had in Afghanistan for anything, because it was the first time she got to leave the United States, the first time she got to see a foreign country and a foreign culture. She learned so much about herself. You know, she had thought that she came from disadvantaged circumstances, but then she was in Afghanistan, one of the poorest nations on the globe, and she saw what real third world poverty is like, and she realized how well off she was by comparison and how good she had it, essentially. So she would never trade that. So I don't think... I'm not sure she would say that enlisting was a mistake exactly. It's more like I think she would say she enlisted not knowing what she was getting in for.
When you talk about her new perspective on like global poverty, it is striking that, you know, money was not plentiful for any of these three women. And you could argue that, you know, they all were adults when they signed on. And but it's certainly not something they might have done had they had adequate resources all the time.
They definitely feel that they volunteered of their own free will. But Michelle, after she ends up getting out of the military, she moves to Denver, Colorado. And while she's there, she finds the progressive veterans community. And for her, it's kind of the first time she feels at home after returning from the deployment in the United States. It matters a lot to her that there are people that share her military service, but also share her political views. And she hasn't often... sometimes she can find people who share her military service, but they don't, you know, share her political views, or she can find people who are as left-leaning as she is, but none of them have served. So for her to find a progressive veteran community, that meant a lot to her. And as she's hanging out with these people, somebody mentions this term, economic draft. And that for her is this light bulb moment where she feels that the last 10 years we got through these wars with essentially an economic draft. Desma and Debbie probably wouldn't use that term. I think they don't share Michelle's point of view exactly. But you do see the military offering them these very large cash bonuses for signing up. At one point, it's $5,000. Another point, it's $8,000. It goes up over time as the military is having more and more difficulty recruiting people. And those cash bonuses are a huge, huge part of why they choose to reenlist. That and the college tuition benefits.
The last image we have of Debbie is her picking back up with her life and also volunteering as a bartender at the VFW.
Mm. Yeah. Debbie is this amazing person who is incredibly gregarious and extroverted and social, and she reveres other veterans. You know, her dad had been in the Army. She was a daddy's girl. She loved him. She just loves these World War II veterans and Vietnam vets who are coming into the VFW where she's working as a bartender. She also knows at this point that maybe she has a problem with alcohol. Michelle and Desma have told her they are worried that she might be drinking too much. So you worry for her, knowing that she's working as a bartender and surrounding herself by alcohol. But you also understand in that moment that she's brightening up the lives of these older veterans, that she's affirming them and giving them, you know, she's an incredibly cheerful, positive person who's always saying nice things to other people. And you've got to believe that she's making these guys' evenings brighter.
Helen, this is a huge responsibility for you to tell their stories, because this is not just a rundown. I mean, there are so many anecdotes and intimate details that we didn't get to in the hour. Can you talk about how you managed that just in your own mind as you wrote the story?
You know, these women gave to me not only hours and hours of interviews, but also letters, diaries, and emails, as I think I've mentioned. But in addition to that, I mean, Desma gave me her entire VA file with therapy notes. And then even she gave me these tape recordings that she and her therapist had made as she was struggling to get through the experience of having lived through an IED blast. I felt a huge responsibility to honor and respect everything about these women, from their military service to whatever trouble they got in, to treat them with dignity and respect. And part of that involved me sharing the manuscript with them in draft form to hear what they thought. And it was really interesting because the three women each had parts that made them uncomfortable, but none of it was stuff about them. Hmm. Whatever they had revealed about their own selves, they were perfectly comfortable sharing. But they each wanted to take out something about a family member that they felt might hurt this other person's feelings.
The new book, I'm sorry we have to jump in. The new book, sure, by journalist Helen Thorpe is called Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War. Helen, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on the show.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.